The Talking Points podcast is produced in partnership with Fee Michael Gibson and clinicaltrialresults.org.
Hi, Mike Gibson coming to you live from AHA 2023, and I'm with the Orbita 2 team. You guys, this was selected as the trial people were most excited about coming into the meeting. I'm joined today by Chris Rajkumar. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And of course, Rasha Alame, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having us, Mike.
Well, maybe you can set the stage just a little bit for our audience. Very brief, what was Orbita 1? And how does Orbita 2 differ from Orbita 1 in design?
Sure. So, Orbita 1 really left us with a very important question. It told us that it showed us the importance of placebo control in our trial design. But we have to remember that Orbita 1 randomized patients in a guideline-directed approach. It randomized patients to either PCI or a placebo procedure on a background of maximally tolerated anti-anginal medications. And it found that in that setting, there was very little difference between having PCI or a placebo procedure.
So at the end of the placebo procedure, they had a sham procedure. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. So they had every step of the procedure, just except the actual insertion of a stent. So they had angiograms, they had a pressure wire done, and they had sedation to mimic the procedure in every possible way.
So that was single vessel disease, multiple anti-anginals. How does Orbita 2 differ from that?
Yeah, so Orbita 2 is now answering the question of how effective PCI is without background anti-anginal medication to work out the unattenuated effect of PCI on angina relief. So there's a number of key differences. As I touched on, the key difference really is that we diverge from guidelines in Orbita 2 and intentionally take patients off their anti-anginal medications. They can build them back in according to a pre-specified protocol, and that's one of the endpoints we're looking at. The other key differences are we also take patients with single and multi-vessel disease in Orbita 2. We follow them up for longer with 12 weeks of follow-up instead of 6. And the primary endpoint is different. In Orbita 1, the primary endpoint was the treadmill exercise time. In Orbita 2, we've taken on a novel clinical endpoint called the angina symptom score. And this is a composite endpoint based on patients' symptoms, which they reported to us every day using a dedicated smartphone app. It also incorporates the number of anti-anginal medications they need. And finally, any clinical adverse events like unblinding because of unacceptable angina, acute coronary syndromes, or death. So it's a composite endpoint that we compare between the two groups.
Now, was it sham controlled again?
Yeah, absolutely. So we usually say placebo controlled, and essentially the patients, just like in Orbita 1, they underwent a blinded procedure whereby they had a identical angiogram pressure wire studies, and then they were sedated with opiates and benzodiazepines. Patients were actually only randomized after that point of sedation. So once we'd confirmed the patients were sedated, they were wearing over-the-ear headphones, listening to music for auditory isolation as well. And at that point, they were randomized to either PCI or placebo. The PCI group gets complete revascularization of all ischemic stenoses at that same visit. The placebo group just remain on the cath lab table for a minimum of 15 minutes, and no further intervention is performed. So yes, it's a full placebo procedure.
And the people caring for the patient after the procedure were blinded to the group, correct?
Absolutely. So as soon as the patient leaves the catheter laboratory, all subsequent medical caregivers are blinded to their treatment allocation. So this goes as far as we don't tell the recovery room staff which medications they've had during the procedures, because obviously the amount of heparin we give may give that away. We don't put any labels on any of the paper notes, for example. So there's no way that information can be transferred. And we have a number of steps. So patients are all discharged with dual antiplatelet therapy.
That's what I was going to ask. So everyone got damped.
Everybody, exactly.
Right.
Regardless of the allocation.
And how many patients were randomized?
So we randomized 301 patients in total. One extra was just for luck. And 151 were randomized to PCI and 150 to placebo.
And what did you find?
So the primary result of Orbiter 2 is that PCI significantly improved the angina symptom score compared to placebo. That indicates a better angina health status in the patients who underwent the revascularization procedure. We found that that result was actually, because we collected data daily from the patients using the smartphone app, we could actually see that effect straight away, immediately following randomization. And it was sustained throughout the 12 weeks of follow-up.
Was there any catch-up phenomenon? I mean, did people in the medical side begin to escalate their anti-anginals and catch up in relief?
Well, interestingly, patients in both arms gradually drifted towards slightly more anti-anginals towards the end. However, you could actually independently verify the difference between the PCI group and the placebo group on every day of the 12 weeks of follow-up. So the difference was sustained out to 12 weeks.
And what other endpoints did you look at, Chris?
Yeah, so we also looked at some of the endpoints from the first Orbiter trial. So we looked at treadmill exercise time. Here we found that PCI offered about a 60-second larger increment in treadmill exercise time compared to placebo. We also found that PCI significantly improved the physician-assessed CCS class, along with all of the domains of the Seattle Angina questionnaire. The patients also underwent stress echocardiography, and that verified that ischemia had been reduced significantly in the PCI group.
Are there any differences in adverse events, like more renal insufficiency in the PCI group?
So the adverse events that contributed to the primary endpoint were unblinding because of intolerable angina, which occurred in one patient in the placebo group, but no patients in the PCI group. Acute coronary syndromes, of which there was 4 in the PCI group and 6 in the placebo group, and there were no deaths at all in the trial. When we looked at this statistically, there was no significant difference in serious adverse events between the two groups.
So what does this mean for us practicing docs, Chris?
Yeah, so I mean, what I think this means most importantly is that we now have our first placebo-controlled data to support the use of PCI as an anti-anginal procedure. We importantly have data now that suggests that we have relative equivalence in terms of PCI for anti-anginal relief, in terms of treadmill exercise time. When we've looked at this in terms of anti-anginal medications, there's actually a relatively similar effect of around 60 seconds, 50 to 60 seconds we see. So although patients in the PCI group consistently had some anti-anginal relief, in many patients it was modest and actually quite comparable to patients to a single full dose anti-anginal medication. What I think this means in practice is that we can now, for the first time, start offering up patients more of a choice. So we can tell them that right from the outset, they have a choice of either an initial anti-anginal medication or an anti-anginal procedure, such as PCI. And there are pros and cons with both of those, but it's a discussion that we can now have.
Great, thanks, Chris. Well, let me ask you, Rasha, how well validated is the anginal score that you used?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, Mike. So obviously what we wanted to do was try and think about the endpoint very carefully. And what we did in selecting this endpoint was use patients, actually. So we had a patient focus group who were part of Orbiter 1, previous patients, and some additional patients who have lived experience of stable angina. And we asked them which endpoints were important to them. And importantly, they didn't really understand exercise time as an endpoint. They felt that what was important to them was the amount of symptoms they had every day. And what was interesting was that in Orbiter 1, we obviously used exercise treadmill time to mimic FDA and European Medicines Agency regulations for anti-anginal agents. But this time we thought, this is a trial about trying to understand what this means for patients, as opposed to a regulation trial. And so it was important to us to bring it back to them. And then we started to think about the questionnaires that we have out there, the other patient-centered endpoints. And what we felt was, and it was very important to me to start thinking about actually taking it back to the source. And for a questionnaire that maybe asks us about symptoms over the last month, it's the way it's in which it's validated is to try and validate it against the real source that you're trying to pick up. And the sort and the thing you're trying to pick up is the amount of episodes of angina. So in fact, when you go back and look at some of these questionnaires, you realize they were validated against daily diaries of angina frequency. So we brought it back to a daily diary. Now, of course, in order to do that, we did it in a more up-to-date, contemporary way, and that was to use a smartphone app. The app was actually developed with patients and physicians, and we tried to make it as simple as possible so that it would literally take them a few seconds every morning to tell us about the symptoms from the day before. And that meant that we could collect symptoms every single day. We then, when we published this, we went on to try in terms of validation. We didn't feel there was much more validation because what you're asking is how much of your pain do you get? But what was important to validate was, did they fill it in? Could elderly patients, you know, find their way around a smartphone app? Could we collect the amount of data we needed? And importantly, was it possible to remind patients and make sure we got all of the follow-up we needed? And in fact, we have managed to get 99.9% of daily entries. And we hadn't predicted a pandemic, but it meant that even over the pandemic, we could collect data from patients every single day and not lose a single data point, essentially, in the overall kind of scheme of things.
I just want to make sure it's clear to myself and the audience, these lesions that were treated were functionally significant, right?
So the lesions, we took severe stenoses based on angiography invasively and also CTCA, which is, of course, a very contemporary pathway, but a pathway that's been around in the UK for a long time. But they had to have evidence of ischemia either non-invasively or invasively prior to randomization, and all of the patients had to meet those criteria.
So you took the medicines away, you do the procedure, PCI gives you about one angel medicine of benefit. Now, let me ask you this, Rasha. I mean, we're not going to take the anti-angels away, right? I mean, most people are going to come to the procedure on anti-angels. That's kind of more of what you answered in Orbital 1. I mean, why, if I can get angina relief with one more anti-anginal, why would I do a PCI?
Yeah, so I think that's the crux of the question. So what we've realized worldwide is actually the vast majority of patients, when you look at the data, don't come to the cath lab on the levels of anti-anginal agents that the guidelines tell us or that Orbiter 1 tested. You know, it's very infrequent to see people on 2 to 3 anti-anginals. So in the real world, for whatever the reasons might be, and we can kind of postulate those, much of the PCI that we do is on far lower levels of anti-anginals. Now, that might be because that it's hard to do, maybe because we need to spend more time and effort on it. But what we're suggesting is, if you actually want to see the biggest bang for your buck from angioplasty, you're going to get that off medications. So in fact, I think much earlier up in the pathway, we need to start talking to patients and we need to start offering them two approaches. One is, we can give you multiple anti-anginal agents and see how you do. The additional benefit of angioplasty on top of that is minimal. And we've seen from Orbiter 1, not statistically significant in the main. There was a small proportion of patients that became angina-free, but they were small. And then there's a second pathway, which says, actually, if we want an angioplasty procedure to work, it has to come up front before anti-anginal agents. But importantly, just as you've said, in both pathways, there's a significant proportion of patients who still have chest pain and symptoms that are unexplained. And there's also a quite equivalent effect between an anti-anginal agent at full dose and angioplasty. And so all of this gets caveated with the risks, the costs, and the various kind of limitations of both approaches. And I think the point is to use this as a personalized approach for each patient.
Now, in the real world, if you didn't do a placebo-controlled trial, the PCI group or PCI patients would get DAPT. The anti-angino group would not get DAPT. So in some ways, this is putting angioplasty in the best light possible. I mean, you're on no anti-anginals, and you really kind of stacked the deck against placebo in terms of the bleeding risk, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely. I mean, so obviously there was always a risk of bleeding with DAPT. In fact, those rates were very, very low. Now, of course, you're right. It was within a 14-week trial, essentially. We're not advocating DAPT as an approach for patients who haven't had PCI. In the trial, for the purposes of blinding, that was important.
No, I understand, but I'm just saying. The trial design minimized the potential signal you might have seen in terms of bleeding risk with the PCI, right?
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah, the DAPT was obviously the same in both arms, but we didn't see a difference in terms of bleeding.
Okay. And then this is kind of an early look, right? I mean, over time, you're going to have potentially some restenosis, still happens. In the intervened group, both groups are escalating their meds. Are you going to just late follow-up to see, you know, was the benefit preserved later?
Yeah, so no. So, I mean, as with ORBITA-1, our view is that for symptom relief, all of the benefit comes from the blinded information. We've got lots and lots of unblinded data out there already. So these patients will not be followed up. And in fact, at the point at which they exited the trial and were unblinded, they returned to standard of care. But yes, I think in that conversation with a patient, you do need to understand that by putting in a stent, you then also have procedural risk and a potential long-term risk. Perhaps there'll be some patients who say, I'd rather take that on board rather than take these anti-anginal medications. And then I suspect there'll be another group of patients who say, actually, I'd rather have the medication. And that's the conversation that I think we can now have.
Now, let me ask you a tough question, Rasha. Sorry I'm being so tough on you today, but you can.
No, we like it.
So would you agree with me that there is about a 0.5% per year risk of stent thrombosis, at least as far as we know, out to 5 years?
Absolutely. And so, of course, what we also know with stent thrombosis is that the risk of mortality is about 50% with each stent thrombosis. So I think that's got to be part of our conversation. And there will certainly be, you know, a long-term risk. We know this to putting in stents. And we're definitely not advocating a sudden increase in the amount of stents that we do for stable angina. But what I think we're starting to understand is where it might work.
I get it. I'm just from a pub, I know 0.5% does not sound like a lot for an individual patient, but what I'm saying from a public health perspective, that's a lot of cases. And, you know, if you just keep that number marching on ad infinitum, That's a lot of risk at the tail of this that you might not face in the medical therapy side. I mean, I can't believe here I am an interventional cardiologist, but I think it's important for
absolutely.
All right, what's ORBITA-3 going to be?
Well, I've got a great idea for ORBITA-3, but I'm not going to give it away. Give us another 5 to 6 years, we'll be back. And as you've probably seen, the ORBITA team is getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, what's really interesting from ORBITA-1 and ORBITA-2 is I think, you know, a decade ago, we probably thought we knew all we needed to know about stable angina. And we're just learning. We need to learn a lot more. So the real bit that will be interesting in the next year, I mean, this result is great and we're excited to tell everyone about it. But the bit that will be interesting is starting to understand the predictors of symptom relief. And what we will have now is a totality of data from 500 patients that were in placebo-controlled trials. And what we're going to try and tease out in that and other studies, the one that formed Chris's PhD, ORBITA-STAR, we're going to try and actually tease out, how do you predict which patients might benefit from a stent before they get to the cath lab so that we can put stents in patients who have the biggest bang for their buck.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Talking to, a lot of the heart flow people, some of the presentations they're making, there's a lot of great data there on non-invasive testing ahead of time that might be helpful to us, using AI and some of the functional and anatomic things that are identified in those kinds of studies. So, maybe we need to be making more of these decisions before people get to the cath lab. I think that's a great idea.
I think that's exactly the approach.
Well, I got to tell you, you know why I think people are so excited about what you're doing? Because it is real docs doing a real study with a real question that we all face. And it's not industry funded. Maybe if it is, it's not.
Absolutely not. We've do things on a shoestring.
Yeah, good. Well, that's what we love. Real questions answered by real docs on a shoestring. So congratulations, you two. Look forward to seeing what you have up your sleeves next. Thanks for joining us today. Right. Thanks to all of you for joining us here from AHA 2023.